One of the lingering mysteries about the Black Death is that how it made the final leap in its journey from the Italian trading post in the Black Sea to Sicily, where it arrived in the autumn of 1347. That's roughly 1,600 miles. And in the 1340s, it was a two-month journey by sea. And getting caught aboard an infected ship with Y. pestis would have been the equivalent of getting caught in a revolving door with a rattlesnake. One hypothesis is that the plague made the journey in leapfrog fashion, from port to port. As a dying crew arrived in a new port of call, Y. pestis would leap from an infected ship to a healthy one and infect its crew during the next leg of the journey. Another hypothesis is that the plague made the journey in a single leap, and some of the crew members survived because they were immune. Though, despite some suggestive evidence, many scientists continue to doubt there is such a thing as permanent immunity to the plague. What we can say with some certainty, because we know how the plague operates, is what happened on the ships during the long two-month journey from Caffa to Sicily. As the days lengthen and the plague takes hold, men would begin to turn on one another, as they would turn on one another later when the plague arrived in Italy. There are beatings, murders, summary executions, mutinies. Only the progress of the pestilence prevents complete anarchy. Men become too ill to kill, then too ill to work. The helmsman, with a neck bobo, is strapped to the mast of the ship. The ship's carpenter, with a bloody cough, to his bench. Gradually, the vessel becomes a menagerie of grotesques. Everywhere, there are delirious men who talk to the wind and stain their pants with bloody anal leakages, and weeping men who cry out for absent mothers and wives, and cursing men who blaspheme God, wave their fists at an indifferent sky and gurgle blood when they cough. There are men who ooze pus from facial and body sores and stink to high heaven. Lethargic men who stare listlessly into the empty horizons and cruel gray sea. Madmen who laugh hysterically and dig filthy fingernails into purple mottled flesh. And dead men whose bloated bodies roll back and forth across the pitching decks till they hit a rail or mast and burst open like piñatas. As the plague burned itself out, millions of exhausted Europeans echoed the words of Petrarch. Once we were a crowd, now we are almost alone. As far as I'm aware, the Irish famine, the subject of my current book, makes no one's list of top 10 disasters. Nonetheless, there are some intriguing parallels between the famine and the medieval plague. Some fall into the category of historical oddities, like similar dates. Both calamities occurred in the second half of the fourth decade of their respective centuries. The Black Death arrived in Europe in 1347, while 1847, Black 47, is forever lodged in the central ventricle of Irish national memory. Roughly speaking, the two events also produced a similar loss rate. A third of Ireland's 8.5 million people disappeared during the famine, as a third of Europe disappeared during the great mortality, though in Ireland's case, flight accounted for a significant percentage of the loss. Between 1846 and 1850, 1 million people died, and roughly 2 million immigrated. Both events also produced mass animal die-offs. From medieval Italy to England, there were reports of massive cattle and sheep moraines. Dogs and chickens were felled by the plague as well. In famine-stricken Ireland, even the birds starved to death. On a cold December night in 1846, the residents of a village named Phillipstown were awakened by the shrieks and cries of birds. The next morning, the December sun rose over a snowfield cluttered with the corpses of dead crows. The Freeman's Journal, a Dublin paper, reported that the dead birds were found to have been reduced to skeletons and to have actually starved to death. Beyond odd, chilling coincidences, the parallels between the events also tell us something about human nature. One is about our feelings toward death. Historian Carolyn Walker Bynum has called the personal death, the notion of my death, a medieval invention. In antiquity, says Professor Bynum, death was seen as a public and a heroic event. But by the time the plague struck in the 14th century, death had become a more intimate and personal affair. It was seen as a time when friends and family gathered to celebrate and bear witness to the life of the deceased, and this new view of death gave rise to a host of new symbols and rituals. Describing the medieval Florentine way of death, Boccaccio wrote, "It was the custom of the women and neighbors of the dead man to assemble in his house to mourn. His kinfolk would gather in front of the home with neighbors and various other citizens. And there would be a contingent of priests whose number varied according to the quality, i.e. status of the dead man. His body would thence be taken to the church, borne on the shoulders of his peers, amid the funeral pomp of candles and sad dirges." And anybody who's seen a Godfather movie knows what those sound like. Despite being among the poorest people in 19th century Europe, the Irish were also grand practitioners of the personal death. It was not uncommon for the Irish peasant to build his coffin years in advance. Often he would prop it up against an outdoor wall of his cabin, where it would provide him with reassurance, and the scores of foreign travelers who visited 19th century Donegal and Kerry to view the Aboriginal Irish with a bit of local color to take home. In the 1830s and 1840s, the average annual income in Ireland was about $400 or $500 in modern money. Nonetheless, even the poorest peasant usually managed to save enough to be waked in a new and decent suit. In many cases, the wake was the first occasion the deceased had looked so respectable. The Irish wake also included keeners, professional mourners, and a large and boisterous crowd of family, friends, and neighbors who would spend several days drinking and dancing around the corpse of the deceased, who would be laid out on a table in his cabin. That is, if he was prosperous enough to own a cabin. I'm old enough to remember to have enjoyed some of these wakes. In both medieval Florence and Victorian Ireland, once death began to seem inevitable to people, the great fear became how they would die. Few things evoked more horror than the thought of dying anonymously, in a mass grave, away from one's church, away from the texture of family and village life, unheralded by mourners and clergy, naked, mutilated by animal and the elements, piled in among the uncoffined dead and entombed between 10 feet of black earth. To escape the cruelty of an anonymous death, medieval plague victims usually turned to relatives. And here and there, a husband, wife, or father would brave the risk of contagion, and contemporaries quickly recognized the contagious nature of the pestilence, to provide the dying relative with the dignity of a personal death. But men like the Sienese cobbler Agnolo de Toro, who wrote, "And I buried my wife and five children with my own hand," were the exceptions. Fear of contracting the plague was so great, in city after city, we hear the same reports from the plague chroniclers. Brother abandoned brother, parent child, sister brother, wife husband, husband wife. In Florence, dying family members would beg for assistance from a relative. The relative would often assent to help at the burial, then slip out of the house when the plague victim had fallen asleep. Most of Florence's 50,000 plague dead were laid to rest anonymously in great open pits, whose construction a local chronicler likened to lasagna. The corpses, he wrote, were laid layer upon layer on top of one another, as one puts a layer of cheese upon a lasagna. In Ireland, the fear of death came to devolve around the coffin. The dying would often resign themselves to burial in a mass grave and with no family or priest present to bear witness to their passing. But as a symbol of personhood, of humanity, the Irish peasant wanted the dignity of burial in a coffin. In County Mayo, a poor neighbor named Patrick McLaughlin refused to put his wife into the ground uncoffined. For nearly a week, McLaughlin returned home each night after a day of road building, fed his five children, then lay down in the straw bed next to the body of his dead wife. Finally, a local priest agreed to buy a coffin to bury Mrs. McLaughlin. Of the million people who died during the famine, about 200,000 died in the disease-ridden workhouses the British built to house paupers. Despite the high death rate at the institutions, the Irish poor continued to flock to them because every workhouse inmate was guaranteed a burial in a coffin when he died. In Albert Camus' novel, The Plague, a priest in a pestilential Algerian city reassures the faithful that the epidemic running in the streets outside is not a random and purposeless event, but rather a visitation of providence. The voice of God is speaking through the afflicted dying in the sunlit streets outside. Something in human nature compels us to find meaning and purpose in inexplicable events. And from prehistory to the recent Asian tsunami, when the environment produces an inexplicable event like mass death, the first place most people look for meaning is heavenward. Like Camus' priest, most of us need to believe that beneath the small, still flame at the dark core of human suffering lies the secret will of God, and through our suffering, it will transform evil into good. During both the Great Mortality and the Irish Famine, the attempts to discern the will of God and transform evil into good fell into two distinct phases. The first was blame. What was so displeasing to God that it evoked a burst of Old Testament wrath? In the case of the Black Death, contemporaries suggested several possible sources of divine displeasure. Henry Knighton, an English monk, believed God sent the plague as a punishment for tournament groupies. The groupies, observed Father Knighton, were the showiest and most beautiful but least virtuous women in the whole realm. They would arrive at tournaments mounted on great snorting, prancing charges and wearing belts thickly studded with gold and silver and provocatively slung across the hips below the navel. Other contemporaries blamed the plague on the disobedience of children, the failing of clergy, and the spread of vice. But lurking beneath the dark core of human suffering, most people saw the Jews. The Christians of Europe were dying in their thousands because the Jews refused to recognize the divinity of Jesus Christ and were poisoning the wells to dispense with his followers, H capital his. It is our turn now, one of the plotters was alleged to say. During the famine, Irish Protestants blamed the chronic failure of the potato crop on Catholic emancipation. God was displeased with the 1829 decision to vest Catholics with some rights of citizenship. Irish Catholics blamed the continual potato famines on the godless, i.e. non-sectarian colleges the British government was establishing in Ireland. However, in Westminster, Whitehall, Downing Street, and generally throughout the green and pleasant land of England, most people blame the famine on the Irish themselves. The slovenly, slothful, alcoholic, illiterate, morally inverted people had called down the wrath of God upon themselves. Ah, the incurable madness of the Irish, wrote the diarist Charles Grenville. Mr. John Walters, chief proprietor of the London Times, the most influential newspaper of the day, expressed the general English view more forcefully. The famine and the plague also offer many examples of the second step in the process, transforming evil into good. To appease God and return the life of the world to harmony and virtue, attempts are made to remove the source of divine displeasure. In the case of the Jews, attempts to right the divine order led to the most vicious pogrom of the Middle Ages and possibly the most vicious pogrom until the Holocaust, although no one can say that really for sure. On May 14, 1348, Im Quinone, a French Jew, returned home from a trip and found his family dead and his home and the homes of other local Jews burned to the ground. That night he wrote, "I sat down and wept in the bitterness of my soul. Would that the Lord in his mercy allow me to see the consolations of Judah and of Israel and permit me and my descendants to rest there forever." In the case of the famine, Westminster and Downing Street's attempts to appease God's wrath and transform evil into good led to the largest, most ambitious, and lethal program of social engineering until Stalin's time. The principal architects of the program were a small group of moralists at the highest reaches of official British government. Evangelical Protestants, the moralists believed the potato failure was a sign of divine displeasure at the backward nature of Irish life. They also believed that to appease God's wrath, it would be necessary to transform the slothful, unenterprising Irish into self-reliant, industrious people, which is to say, to turn them into little Englishmen. The moralists further concluded the way to transform Ireland into a nation of wakeful minds and stout hearts was to use the famine relief program as an instrument of behavioral change. Believing the cankerworm of dependency, particularly dependency on government, was responsible for most of the moral rot in Ireland, the moralists concluded that while Britain would supply the peasantry with some food to replace the lost potato, to foster self-reliance and responsibility, the peasantry would be required to work for its food and to avoid undercutting the private traders who were also importing food into Ireland the government would sell its provisions, which was mostly Indian cornmeal, at market rates. In August 1846, when the potato failed completely, a stone of 14 pounds of cornmeal cost a shilling at the retail level where the peasant bought his food. 5 months later, in January of 1847, in Dublin City, a price of that stone had tripled to 3 shillings. Meanwhile, due to a combination of deepening malnutrition and unusually severe winter weather, the public works laborers on the programs the British had set up, and they were working on piece rate wages, which meant as they got tireder and more exhausted, they could do less work. And it was a very, very snowy winter, the winter of 1846, had been so reduced in power that they were making only 2 shillings a week. And each of these laborers usually had 4 or 5 children at home and a wife to feed. By early January 1847, it became common to see women in Cork City begging with dead infants in their arms. In Galway, a dead mother was found lying on a road with a dead baby attached to her breast. Before dying, the starving infant had bitten the woman's nipple off. On Christmas Eve, 1846, a British relief officer in County Clare wrote a colleague in London about a visit he had made that afternoon to a public works site, shut down to teach the laborers a lesson in discipline. "I saw women and little children scattered across the open turnip fields like flocks of famishing crows," the officer wrote. "They were devouring raw turnips, the mothers half naked, shivering in the snow and sleet, while their children screamed with hunger. If such scenes were necessary to appease God and transform the Irish into a morally upright people," the officer said he was not sure he could stand it. He closed the letter by saying he had never been so unmanned by a sight. Let me just kind of add parenthetically, there's also a third parallel. And that's the notion of the ability of civilization for the social framework of society to hold an incidence of mass death. In fact, I mentioned earlier that book, the government commissioned Disaster and Recovery about thermonuclear war. What the government was interested in finding out was, if we suffered 40 or 50 million casualties, would American society be able to pick itself up and continue? And you'd be happy to know your government concluded it could. And in fact, in both the famine and in the plague, people came to the very edge. What Boccaccio said about brother deserting brother, father deserting child, etc. There was an enormous amount of that. There was also an enormous amount of flight from cities. In Ireland, by December of 1846, it resembled what the pictures you see today of modern Somalia, where you just see arms of wild armed men wandering through the meadows, the snow-covered meadows, breaking into homes, stealing food. Most of these men were either couldn't find jobs or, like a lot of public works laborers, the wages the British were paying were so low compared to how high food prices had risen that they couldn't live on it. And so they were ransacking everything that moved. But in both cases, society held by the skin of its teeth. And first, there was that urgent need in both of them to get corpses into the ground quickly. I mean, otherwise, the disease would have been grown even worse. And there were always people who came forward and would organize the burials or who would somehow keep the records. They would be notaries, a kind of modern-day equivalent of a lawyer, who could stay in the cities and take some records and take some notes. There was always enough that the framework skeleton of civilization held. In the case of the Irish, there were two factors that kept civilization intact. One was the fact that the British had almost 30,000 troops in Ireland, plus a 7,000 constabulary manned force. But the second factor, which probably was even more important, is the hold of the church. During the famine, the church served as a nationalist institution, the way the Polish church acted as a nationalist institution under the Nazis and the communists. And the priests had such authority and power within the community that they were usually able to prevent outbreaks of violence, although toward the end it really was beginning to get dicey, and there were times when the British were worried that their authority would disappear. But it didn't. It held. I think part of this is you know, that old cliche, human spirit. And it's resiliency, but before the human spirit gets up and takes too large a bow, I would have to say that after 7 or 8 years of this, it seems to me the other reasons the violence and chaos subsided is because people are just physically and emotionally exhausted. There's just no energy left to do anything. People just sit and wait to die. They accept the fact of death, and it's just sitting there and waiting for it. They're exhausted. So there are those three parallels that run through both episodes. Thank you very much.